I want to know, what's the best baseball story you've ever been a part of, told, or heard? What makes that story so good? By what standard do we say it's good? Now that's a good question.
Let me hear you! Go ahead now! A-1, A-2, A-3!
Welcome to In the Bullpen with Mark Dewey. You're listening to the Fight Laugh Feast Network. Thank you for joining us.
And look who's coming up. High fly ball into right field. She is gone!
Well, that right there is undebatably a good story. Baseball history is filled with stories like that, filled with colorful characters. It's one of the things that makes the game so great and so enjoyable. And it's one of the things that we're missing right now. We can think back and recall the old stories, and people are doing that all over the internet. But there are no new stories, at least not on the field. But why do we say that a story is a good story? Is it simply a matter of personal preference? What do we mean by good? Is there an objective way to determine that? Well, I want to talk about that, but first, I do want to bring us up to speed on a couple of news stories. Again, nothing going on in the field, but some things still happening in baseball. The first one is something that is simply a technicality, really. The Chicago Cubs and St. Louis Cardinals were scheduled to play a baseball series in London, England in June, and Major League Baseball has officially canceled that. No surprise to anybody. A bit of a better story, I would say a lot better story, Major League Baseball has determined that it will give minor league baseball players $400 per week through the end of May, or if the season were to start up before that, until the season starts. So that also is good news. $1,600 a month for some minor league players, that's actually more than they would have been making playing. For some, it's going to be less, but nonetheless, it is providing for all that they can pay their rent, pay their bills, those kinds of things. Along with that, Sin Shu Chu, the designated hitter for the Texas Rangers, contributed about $190,000, $1,000 for every minor league player in the Rangers system. So that gives them another essentially month of salary because of his kindness. It was at least a week ago, maybe two, that Adam Wainwright and his wife Jenny had offered and given $250,000 for the minor league players in the St. Louis Cardinals organization. So again, given the fact that there's probably 190 to 200 players, maybe a little bit more, you're talking about $1,000 or more for each player in the Cardinals minor league system because of the kindness and goodness of Adam and Jenny Wainwright. So in these very difficult times, it's stories like that that we say, well, those are good stories. That's really good. It's good to hear those kinds of things. With so much going on right now that can be depressing and discouraging, those are uplifting and encouraging. But I mentioned on the last podcast that I might have a podcast before Monday, and of course, we're not to Monday yet. And the reason that I brought it up and the reason that I thought I might is because of a story that I heard last week. Now, the actual story itself is very old, but it's what happened just a week ago that makes it matter now. It's what happened a week ago that really has me fired up and thinking, have we learned anything? Do we have any consistency in what we're saying? I mean, until the COVID-19 hit, everybody was furious about the Houston Astros sign-stealing scandal. We're still waiting to hear about the Red Sox. We don't know if any other teams will be named down the line or not, but they were furious. And they were crying out against cheating and cover-up and all of that. And then I heard this interview about a story that happened a long time ago, but it had to do with cheating and cover-up. And I'm hearing things like, it's the best baseball story I've ever reported on. That the person that I'm going to focus on was told when he did what he did by an opposing player, dude, that's awesome. He has been called heroic. I was told that it put a grin on a lot of people's faces. That a very prominent person said that it's a story that needs to be told. Needs to be told because they thought it was a good story. In and of itself, people were and are still smiling and laughing about this story. Many are praising the person who is really the main character in this story, including people in authority within Major League Baseball. So now you're probably saying, all right, dude, get on with it. What happened? What are you talking about? Well, I'm talking about something that has been referred to as Batgate. And it took place on July 15th, 1994. Now, again, remember, it's not what happened that's really bothering me right now. I mean, what happened bothered me, but it's how we're looking at it right now on this side of the most recent scandal with the sign stealing, as well as well removed from the so-called baseball steroids era and that scandal. And it involved, to start, Albert Bell. Albert Bell was playing for the Cleveland Indians at the time. He was a very good hitter, one of the better hitters in the American League at the time. And on this day, they were playing in Kaminsky Park against the White Sox. Now, to hear how good Albert Bell was in 1994, and remember, that was a season that the strike ended it early after 114 games. Albert Bell that season played in 106 games. He hit .357 with 36 home runs and 101 RBI. He had a great year. Well, about a month before the strike, July 15th, against the White Sox, the manager of the White Sox, Gene Lamont, had gotten word that Albert Bell was corking his bat. And so, by rule, he could ask the umpires to check one of the opponent bats from the other team, the Indians, and he did so in the first inning. Top of the first inning, Albert Bell comes up. Gene Lamont says to the umpires, I want you to check his bat. The umpires take the bat and they look at it and they decide that it's suspicious enough that they're going to remove the bat from the game and they're going to put it up in the umpire's room, and then when the game is over, they'll examine it and find out indeed if there's cork in the bat. So that's the cheating part of it. Now, the part that I want to focus on is something else, and it really became even bigger than the cheating part as this unfolded over the course of years and decades. There was a pitcher for the Cleveland Indians named Jason Grimsley, and he was on the bench during this game. And while this is going on, while the umpires have the bat in their hand, and it's obvious that they're going to remove the bat, he sees that people are very concerned about what's happening. And from his telling of the story, he basically says, well, what's going on here? And he is told, well, Albert Bell's bat's corked. And he said, I think I can help out here. And from my perspective, he actually even asked permission from people in authority, and they granted him permission to follow through on what he was going to do. Now, I don't think they knew all the details. They just knew that he thought he could get the bat. Well, here's what he did. He left the clubhouse, or left the dugout, and he said it took him about 4 innings to pull this off. He left the dugout, and he went up into the visiting clubhouse at Kaminsky, and I believe through the manager's office, he climbed onto a desk, and he went up through a drop ceiling. And then he shimmied himself, and Jason Grimsley, I think, is a 6'3", 6'4", man. He shimmied himself across the top of cinder blocks. So you're talking about, what, 10, maybe 12 inches wide. He shimmied himself above the drop ceiling on top of the cinder blocks, got his way eventually to the umpire's room, dropped down into the umpire's room, took Albert Bell's bat, and replaced it. There was a big problem, however. Albert Bell apparently had no bats that weren't corked. And so he took an Albert, that's Jason Grimsley, took Albert Bell's bat and he replaced it with a bat from another player on the team, Paul Konerko. He shimmied himself back, came back into the visiting clubhouse, put on his uniform, went into the dugout, watched the end of the game. When the umpires returned, as soon as they walked in the umpire's office, they said, wait a second, there's some things going on here that are a little bit concerning. And then, of course, the most obvious thing is this isn't the bat we took out of the game. So there was a big deal. 2 days later, the Indians finally turn over Albert Bell's bat. And in front of Albert Bell, they x-ray the bat, and then they cut the bat open, and it has cork. Albert Bell is suspended. I believe it was 10 games up front. It got cut down to 7 or 8 games. But that really ended up not being the biggest part of the story. The biggest part of the story is who stole this bat. And finally, about 5 years later, it came out publicly that it was Jason Grimsley who stole the bat. And he told the story in much more detail than I just did about how he stole that bat. And just a week ago or so, he was talking about that story, and that's when the kind of comments that I conveyed to you were being said. That's when there was a lot of chuckling and a lot of laughing. And I'm thinking to myself, what is going on here? I mean, I appreciate the adventure behind what he had actually pulled off physically to get the bat. I even appreciate, to a degree, the devotion that he showed to his teammate. It was remarkable. And how he was willing to risk himself both physically in the act of getting the bat and from a standpoint of legally, both with the league and even the law enforcement, of stealing this bat. So I can see some intrigue there. And again, I don't want to go back to 94, and I don't want to unduly criticize Jason Grimsley, because that's not really what this is about. We all make foolish and sinful decisions. That's not the biggest problem. It is a problem, but it's not the biggest problem. The problem I'm having is, how can we now laugh at and kind of build this up as a great thing when what happened is somebody cheated and then somebody else then stole and broke the law to try to cover that up? We're saying we want a level playing field. We want the game to be clean. Well, we surely cannot then pump up stories like this and laugh about them, or we're being radically inconsistent. Now, I tried to look at a video that was first put on the internet on December 30th, 2014. I couldn't pull it up. Maybe it's been removed. But the caption under the video said, "This is a must-watch for all Tribe fans, both young and old." And I really wish I could have seen the video, because the question I have is, why was it a must-watch? Was it a must-watch because of what I've seen everywhere else? What a good story? Or was it a must-watch for old and young to teach them, you know what? Devotion can go too far. Being willing to sacrifice for another person can go too far. We all need to learn from this. We don't want to make that same mistake. I hope. I'm betting against it, but I hope. But that brings me back to the question. How is it that we determine something is good? Even a story is a good story. What is the objective standard? By what standard do we measure anything? Now, the Bible itself is filled with stories about people who make foolish and sinful decisions. So there's, in that sense, there's nothing wrong with telling the story. But the Bible never celebrates that sin. The Bible never laughs at that sin. But that's what we're doing as it regards this particular story. And of course, the standard where we measure this story or anything else, the goodness or the badness, the rightness or the wrongness of any action, is from the Bible. And the Bible very clearly tells us that we shouldn't cheat, and it very clearly tells us that we shouldn't do what is contrary to the will of God in order to try to help out even our best friend, even our spouse or our child. But that leads to a very good question. How should a Christian handle a situation like that? If a Christian knows that one of his teammates, or more than one of his teammates, is cheating, or maybe even a manager or a general manager, whatever the case may be, how do we handle it? And I thought about that. I thought, what if I was in that situation and I knew that? How would I handle it? Now, I'm going to say this. I know how I ought to handle it, and I surely hope I would handle it that way. But of course, I don't know that for a fact unless I was actually put in that position. But the way I look at it is this way. If it's a brother, if it's a believer, it's a Christian who's done the wrong, then I need to follow Matthew 18. And I need to follow that principle. And in baseball, this person, whoever he might be, whether it's a player, a manager, whatever it might be, often doesn't live during the season in his hometown. And therefore, his elders bring it before the church would be somewhere else. And it would be complicated, no doubt. It would require more than the usual Matthew 18 process, but it shouldn't in any way hinder me from following that. But what if the person who did the cheating, took the steroids, used the cork bat, stole a bat, what if that person wasn't a believer? Well, I still think that it should be handled from a biblical perspective, which is, I would hope that what I would do is go to that person and say to that person, listen, this is what I know, and it's wrong, and you need to fess up. And if he said to me, get out of my face. Who are you and what are you talking about? You go worship your God. Leave me alone. Well, then I would, again, try to follow that principle of bringing one or two other witnesses with me. And if nothing was getting done, then I would have to go to the proper authority, whoever that might be, and say, This is what I know. You need to go talk to so-and-so and find out what he has to say about it. Again, would I? I sure hope I would. But the reason I bring this up is because we have to be consistent. And we see things going on around us in baseball, in our country, in the world, because of all that's happening with COVID-19. And we need to slow down a little bit, just like here, as we appreciate this story and say, wait a second, how should I view this? By what standard do I determine what's right, what's wrong, and how I should respond to what's going on? Now, that may have provided the impetus for me having this podcast in between the normal Monday releases or dropping of podcast. But it's not the only thing I want to do. I would love to talk about or even play highlights of last night's game. But of course, we don't have any. So I thought to myself, well, what can we do? What can I do to try to give a good story? Something that we can be excited about. Something that we can enjoy, even though there's nothing going on in the field. And I started thinking back about what I spoke about as it regards the Hall of Fame motto, preserving history, honoring excellence, connecting generations. And I thought, you know what I want to do? I want to bring back some of the exciting moments in baseball. We do it obviously in the intro with Gibby's home run and Vince Scully's call of it, but I want to do that. And what I decided I was going to do is that I was going to have this portion of the podcast bring us back, take us back to something that we can remember, that we can rejoice in, that we can talk about, wow, that was a really great moment in baseball history. And I decided that I wasn't going to say anything about what it was that was coming up. I was just going to let it play and then afterwards fill in some details. But I've talked enough as it is, so let's go to it.
Has tied it 7-7. Unbelievable. Freeze hits it in the air to center. We will see you tomorrow night.
Now, those are no doubt days that David Freese and the 2011 St. Louis Cardinals and all Cardinal fans will treasure. Not so much so if you're a Rangers fan or a member of that Rangers team, but what a great game. As a matter of fact, some would argue maybe the greatest game ever in Major League Baseball history, and that's quite a claim, but it's definitely up there. Now, a little bit of a background. That was what you heard was the ending of Game 6 of the 2011 World Series. And what you first heard, the call of David Freese hitting the triple to tie the game. Here's the situation. We're in St. Louis. The Cardinals are losing in the World Series 3-2. It is the bottom of the ninth inning. They're losing by 2 runs. There are 2 outs, and David Freese has a 1-2 count on him. So in other words, the Texas Rangers are 1 strike away from winning the World Series. And the person that Freese is facing is Neftali Feliz. Neftali Feliz is on the mound, and in 2010-2011, he was one of the better closers in all of Major League Baseball. In 2010, he was an All-Star, he won the American League Rookie of the Year, and he saved 40 games with a 2.73 ERA. In 2011, the regular season prior to this World Series, he saved 32 games with a 2.74 ERA. So, it wasn't looking good. Freese, the first call you hear is Freese hitting the triple, driving in 2 runs to tie the game when they were 1 strike away from elimination. Then the second call that you hear happens in the 11th inning. And now Freese is back up again. And by the way, the Cardinals were also 1 strike away from losing in the 10th inning. But now here we are in the bottom of the 11th inning. Freese comes back up. hits a walk-off home run. Now, a great part of the story, as exciting as the game was, and it's a great story in many ways, but a good part of this story is that David Freese grew up in the St. Louis area. He was a native of St. Louis. And so he is playing for his home team in front of family and friends, and he is the hero of this game. And not only that, he is awarded the most valuable player for the entire World Series. That's a great part of the story. But talk about connecting generations. Joe Buck, who is the broadcaster who makes those calls, his call of the walk-off home run in the bottom of the 11th has a truly good story behind it. But that's a conversation for another day. So join us next time for In the Bullpen on the Fight Laugh Feast Network. Thank you for listening.